Hi, I'm Jill Trebilcock.
And I'm Stephen Roberts.
And we're here today with Stuart Twemlow. Hello, Stuart.
How are you, Jill and Stephen?
This is number 5 of a series of interviews, right, Jill?
Yeah, it is. It's really lovely to see you, Stuart. Yes, this is number 5 of a series of interviews with Stuart Twemlow. We're very lucky to have you here, Stuart, because you're such a brain, and we love your brain, and love to know so much from
you. Quite physically handsome, you know.
Oh, you're incredibly handsome. This is why we want you on this sort of podcast, so that everyone can see your natural beauty.
Yes, and we were going to talk about gun violence today.
We are. But you're too beautiful to shoot, so...
Well, I could just sit here in the next 45 minutes. I can meditate and say nothing.
That would be great.
The matter of gun violence is an issue of huge importance in the United States. It's not an issue of huge importance in America, in Australia. I understand that. But since we're broadcasting in a broad way, one way or the other, it's going to become an increasing issue, because more and more guns, and I'm not talking here about big guns, handguns, are becoming distributed by the major criminal groups. Primarily, a lot of that is controlled now by the Russian mafia, the Jamaican mafia called Posse, and the Chinese mafia. The Italian mafia, which the name emerged, has moved itself away from a great deal of the horrifying prostitution, child pornography, mass murder, assassination, strong-arming things, and drugs, and tried to clean its act up and focus primarily on criminal activities within casinos and gambling. So we now have to deal with several in the United States major mafias that control gun distribution. So the whole idea of doing things with pawn shops or gun shops or places that legally sell guns is becoming increasingly a fantasy of lawmakers, because the majority of guns in the United States are sold out of the back of cars. I had a boy who used to spend every weekend terrified under his bed because his house was full of gunslingers. Same boy had seen his grandfather commit suicide with a shotgun in his mouth, blew his head off. And this kid was terrified every weekend because, you know, his father would bring in all these people and sell them guns. So, okay, if we put that aside, then the issue becomes, what is gun violence and how is violence in general defined? And I want to just, there's, for example, the word homicide used in the United States is not widely used elsewhere. I think in Australia you just call it murder. But whatever it is, homicide victims in general are known to the murderer.
Yes.
That's number one. In more than 65% of cases, they're known to the murderer. And often drugs and alcohol are involved in the killings.
Mm-hmm.
Those are not a problem. Your country, Australia, shares exactly the same problem as the United States. And probably the number of murders of that type are the same for 100,000 of population. And in this country, approximately 9, perhaps 10 people per 100,000 are killed why what Americans call homicide, you would call murder. And that's half of the rate of suicide. These are fairly rare conditions. In spite of all of the hoo-ha about American violence, it's quite rare, and that's why there'll never be any really reliable statistics on it. But let me just go ahead and define. There's a subtype of homicide you could call societal transference killers. These are people who kill a political figure or a movie star. Why transference? Because the movie star or political figure has meaning to that person that only they know. And there's plenty of them. You know, the guy that tried to kill Ronald Reagan. I mean, there's in America has plenty of them, and I'm sure you may have had one or two in Australia. I don't know.
What about the John Lennon one, the guy who killed John Lennon?
That's a very good example. Mm-hmm. So that type of killer is another type of killer. Criminologists distinguish between murder and mass murder. For example, mass murder is defined as killing four or more persons by one or a few assailants within a single event. Mm-hmm. And there's another one version of mass murder is called spree killing. And that means a killer who commits murder in one or two locations with virtually no break in between. That's fairly rare.
We had one of those in Melbourne called the Hoddle Street Massacre. That guy moved from a couple of places, yeah.
Okay. Another category that America is very well known for, and 75% of these types of killings occur here, is called serial killing. And serial killing, the killer will murder three or more individuals with a cooling off period between them. And after the killings, he is not upset or disturbed in any way, unlike mass murder or spree killing. The serial killer is relieved by the killing.
Oh, why is he relieved?
I'll go into that in a minute. And he plans the next killing. And they're an unusual group because they rarely, if ever, use guns. They mostly torture their victims to death because they like to see people in misery. Mm. Now, as you can see, there's a lot of varieties of murder. It's not a single category, and the motivation of people. Now, with regard to gun violence, that's the favorite method mass murderers use. And it's also the favorite method of spree killers and people that we call murderers. That is, people who murder somebody they know. Most of them use guns. The only group that really doesn't. By guns, I mean things also like bombs. The only ones that don't is the serial killer, and that's another whole separate deal. 75% of the world's serial killings occur in the United States. That's a whole thing in itself. Now, what the point I'm trying to make about if you try and take the killer and categorize them, which is what a lot of people want to do for reasons that I think are quite incorrect and disturbed, then you can find a variety of categories. But they're so different. You, in the end, realize that they don't help you because every killer seems to have a different pattern, different childhood upbringing, a different every type. There's only really one type of killer that kills in the name of large group identity.
Mm-hmm. But.
And this is a type of killer, it's easy enough to define him because he carries often a religious or some sort of theistic background. For example, he's part of the jihad under Osama bin Laden. He's an activist for this or that religion. And that supersedes any personality he may have. One group I'm very interested in are the suicide bombers. I've been studying them for quite a number of years. In fact, we have at this moment.
They're a bit hard to interview.
What?
They're a bit hard to interview.
Well, they're very hard to interview because they're usually dead.
That's what I mean. That's the joke, yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean, there is a joke. So we infer all this from observation, and the suicide bombers in general are kids that are poor, they have no home, they have no identity, and some religious group takes them over and conditions them into thinking jihad is about to happen. We have an actual research project trying to get money from the federal government called a counterterrorism initiative, which involves training potential suicide bombers, and the training is going to be educate them and give them enough to eat and give them a life to live. And then our theory is those so-called suicide bombers will no longer be interested in being suicide bombers. Once again, the legal approach to it, which is punish them, you know, categorize them into groups that are beyond hope, and then everything will be fine. And the world is full of examples just from the 20th century where none of that has ever worked, not ever.
Exactly. We want to pathologize them, but even if you look at the term jihad, jihad, I think, means to have like a spiritual war.
Yeah.
And so, and actually the spiritual war is actually meant to be against your own sort of your own sort of delusions that stop you from being a, you know, self-realized person, a compassionate, self-actualized person. But instead, jihad has been externalized. And but there's that sort of part in us that does like to have that sort of national or territorial or familial, or not familial, but that battle. And so it's like they've harnessed that aspect, isn't it?
Dr. Crumlow.
Hang on. Go on.
Well, no, go ahead.
That was good. I will, yeah. And so if you use that same energy with that kind of person to get them to fight for something else that's non-harmful but it's actually proactive, then that would definitely be an impulse that could be transformed, isn't it? Used in a different way.
See, my feeling is that the project I mentioned has been going on for many years. So far we've had very famous people support it, but nobody give a single penny to it. If anybody wants to from your audience, I would be very happy to hear about it. It's we have very good contacts, and we have cooperation from Russia and most of the Balkan countries and many, many difficult countries. The point I'm trying to make is you don't want to just distract serial killers with something better to fight for. You want to make it so they don't want to be serial killers.
Yes.
Suicide bombers. Suicide bombers are just like very desperate people who will do anything to get something to eat. That's our theory. And if you provide them with what they want to get to eat and you provide them with an education that makes them better employable, they will not be serial suicide bombers.
Yeah, well, I'd like to argue with that theory a little bit because I can see how that could get a young person sort of involved in it, but it has to be more complicated than that because you do end up blowing yourself up.
Well, it seems like it, but you know what? I noticed that somebody on your line, it may have been you, Stephen, has a little quote from Joseph Goebbels, the very famous Nazi war criminal. And he said, if you say a lie enough times to a large enough group, everybody eventually will believe it. I think that's true, especially of children. They believe what you say.
Yes.
I had my oldest boy, used to think the moon was made of green cheese, and that's because I told him that when he was very little. When he was about 8, I heard him arguing with his friends that my daddy said the moon was made of green cheese.
Jill.
So it must be true. Yeah,
Jill.
Go see
me.
You've lost your video, Jill. Okay, there you go.
Sorry, it's back, yeah.
It's trying to come back. Okay.
I think young children will believe anything an adult tells them. Look at the Red Guard. We've just had a series of apologies from old Red Guards who are now middle-aged to older people who realize the horror of what they did in the name of Mao Zedong that led to the murder of many, many people by him.
Oh, are they starting to feel guilty? I mean, you know, of course they are.
Yeah, they are.
Oh.
As children, they didn't feel guilty because their parental figures said it was okay to do. I had a father told him that American soldiers ate their children. When he was 4 years of age, he remembers that specifically. So, you know, children are actually, from the point of view of war, very important to push the idea of the reason for the war, what many researchers call a propaganda.
Yes. My father nearly died twice. And the second time he did die, but the first time he sent for me, he was in Queensland, and I went up, and he was in hospital, and he was in a terrible fever, and he said he was in the war for 6 years.
Yeah.
And he said, I used to manage a hospital like this when I was in the war, full of Japanese soldiers. And then he started to imagine them, and then he just burst into tears, and he was just saying, why did we do it? He just crying and crying, you know. And yeah, it was really interesting, and I was really grabbing to give him some comfort. And I thought he was dying at the time, and I said, well, you were young, Dad, you know, I mean, you were told to do it, you know, you believed in what you were doing. You were 19 when you were recruited. And he was saying, yeah, we were young. That was the thing that he kept, and then I said, you just didn't know what you were really doing in terms of psychically or spiritually. And he kept saying that too, you know, yeah, we didn't know what we were doing. But he was really crying about it, and he was just, you know, incredible suffering.
Well, you see, I mean, with that, I don't want to be unpleasant to your relative or anybody else who's had to deal with mass murder, mass killings. But this was essentially, is now called the Eichmann defense. It's like, as you know, Eichmann was a clerk in the Nazi government. He was one of the last of the Nuremberg people that was convicted based on World War II crimes.
Mm-hmm.
All he said, and it was absolutely true, most likely, mm-hmm. I did this because I was ordered to. It was my job. The fact is, you, as far as I know, and I don't know this for sure, but I think the French government and the French army military is the only military that allows the soldier to make some judgment about the legality of what their commanders tell them to do.
Right.
Most military say you do whatever your officer says and that's it.
Even if Dad ordered them too. Dad was,
it's an order, but the French allow some misgivings on the part of the troops to allow to not continue an order military gives them.
The French, they're such philosophers. They, you know, they've obviously thought about it a bit. Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, well, it was sort of, my point really is, yes, people do later in life, and that's where we were talking about, rue what they did when they were younger, when they have time to reflect and they've no longer engaged in the same conditions and the same sort of habitual thought patterns.
Mm-hmm. Large portions of the world allow revenge to be a legitimate form of eradication of guilt. There's a particular case in the New York Times today of a woman who is terribly badly raped by 13 men in India. Now, it turned out her family had not reported this, in part because in her tribe, the criminal court, which was a duly recognized court, it didn't have attorneys, but it was some some sort of Indian version of a court that was legal. Not only convicted her of trying to marry outside her tribe, but even though her tribe required no penalty for marrying outside the tribe, the legal group sentenced her to gang rape by a variety of men to punish her for marrying, wanting to marry outside of her tribe.
Mm-hmm.
That was done in the name of a law that governs a great deal of law in India. And that's not only India that has these very primitive, very brutal laws that are now starting to become more and more obvious. So the idea of rule of law that you live under in Australia and I and Stephen live under in the United States is a very delicate thing.
Good. And you've put your glasses on because you've gone right where Stephen wanted you to go. But Stephen's actually just away for a minute here. But that's something that is a very important thing, because at the moment you're having a big debate about people that want to take guns away from people.
Yeah. And that's rampant in the United States, as you know, at the moment.
Mm. And so what do you have to say about that, Stuart? Because
well,
the thing is, I'd like to keep my guns.
You what?
If I don't have guns, and I never wanted a gun, but if I had a gun because I needed a gun, then I wouldn't want someone to take my gun away, because I would like it for protection.
Well.
And I wouldn't like you to have a gun and me not have a gun, because then you're at an advantage and I'm at a distinct disadvantage.
Yeah, but you'd then have to trust that I wouldn't kill you. I'd be your friend.
That's right. And that's what I am like at the moment. But if I was in America, where they have a lot of fear of, or in China, I mean, there are a couple of reasons I wouldn't want to have a gun, because I'd be scared you'd take my gun from it and turn it on me anyway.
Yeah.
But if I was in a country where I had to have protection, and in America they're very scared that the government want to take all their guns, so that they have more of a military government.
Well,
and
we see United States, now we get down to the nitty-gritty. As an Australian, if you want to talk about it, you're talking about another country. It's not like your country. Your country is essentially a reformed British colony. It was civilized by the so-called British occupiers, and whatever, for whatever that means. America was not. America was civilized by people who were essentially unable to stay in England because of the craziness of George the Fourth, I think.
Oh, yes, no, stop there. We should remove the word civilized, I think. But
whatever
it must
he
be
said,
a new word. Yes.
Any people away from the from England, and the many
the madness of King George,
right? And they set up their own country.
And there were a lot of Puritans too, weren't they?
Yeah, or a lot of people that England didn't like,
right?
And they all came here, and then they went through a massive civil war. I think more people were lost in this civil war than the whole of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Then they set up a democratic government, what has come to be the largest and most open democracy in the history of the human race. Now, I'm defending America now a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
This is a synthetic country, as one historian called it. It's a series of countries with little groups of people that come from other countries and don't really want to be here. They want to be in their own countries. So when I lived in Kansas, I went to a Swedish village, a Czechoslovakian village, a French village, and there were others. And in those villages, that's how they operated. The country is not a single unit that operates according to a single theme. It's a series of patched together countries of people who generally don't want to be here if it possibly could happen. And it's caused enormous differences between those pieces. So now, everybody's trying to solve that. And I'll tell you what I would do with gun violence, just to answer.
Yeah, that's what I want to know. What would you do? And why?
I'm reflecting here the University of Virginia's Consortium for Risk-Based Firearm Policy.
All right? Risk-Based Firearm Policy. Yep.
The first thing, dump the idea that anybody who shoots is mentally ill.
Yeah.
That's simply not true.
Yeah. Because I could shoot without being mentally ill.
Right. It causes a great deal of embarrassment to mentally ill people who come under suspicion just because they're mentally ill. Second, state laws need to be strengthened after a person has had a psychiatric hospitalization at where they are at higher risk for violence. In other words,
well, hang on, let's go back to the first one, because you might like to talk on that just for a tiny bit longer, because I didn't reflect on that very well. I reflected it back to myself, which I sort of often do because I think that it helps people relate to it, and that's why I sort of tell stories about myself. But would you like to say why people use a gun and not be mentally ill? Like people who shoot rabbits or take lives of other life forms and bring the food home for the family are considered to be quite mentally sane. In fact, the prime ministers and, that's no good example, but you know what I mean? Like there's plenty of well-accepted people in society do shoot.
Right. You see, the point we're talking here about the number of people that shoot animals for fun is actually probably overall, in terms of the meat output for people to eat, is tiny, less than 1% of the necessary meat consumption in the United States. Most of the animals killed for consumption are killed in an automatic way by companies that don't do it, even with guns. I mean, I had a job once in a what you would call here a slaughterhouse, killing cattle. I couldn't stand putting a bolt through their brain because the animals knew it. I got out of that after 3 days.
Hey, Jill.
Yeah.
Hey, Dr. Twemlow.
Yeah.
I think what's being remiss here, what is missing, is the morality of any civilization, especially here in America. We do have, I don't know, probably over 85% of the world's population, or the world's supply of guns, and we are only 5% of the population. So, if there was a moral society, not just here in America, but anywhere in the world, there really wouldn't be any need for any type of weaponry.
Well, but Steve, the issue is the average person after work on a Friday is not thinking, how moral am I? They're thinking, I want to go out tomorrow with my son and shoot a bunch of squirrels or deer. They don't even see it as a moral question.
I do.
It's just what people do.
Well,
I'm talking here about America. I'm not talking about Australia.
Sure. There we get into another argument, too. The society in the last 150 years has made us into working slaves for these little enjoyments that you're talking about. Work 50, 60, and 70 hours a week, slave over whatever you happen to do for a living, just to go out on a Saturday or Sunday and shoot these little animals.
Yeah, right. Well, listen, buddy, here's my thing. A question to you would be, and I'm not advocating shooting animals. I hated it. I've only shot one animal in my life, and I stopped after it because it didn't die and they had to follow it and shoot it. It was a deer. I don't kill animals. I photograph them. What I am, however, is a realist politically. The chief senator of the Democratic Party, Reid, in America, is an ardent shooter of animals and a member of the National Rifleman's Association. And he's a liberal.
That's his claim, though.
Well, whatever his claim, here's the fact. The facts are Americans aren't going to give up their guns immediately. And my issue with that argument is even if every gun shop in America closed tomorrow, would make no difference to the number of handguns and other automatic weapons on the street. Because the majority of them come from organized crime.
And from the boots of cars, as you were saying, and it would just build the underworld like prohibition.
That's correct.
Oh.
I think America, unlike Canada, is not in a position to simply, I would be in favor of closing gun shops and pawn shops and making all that illegal. I think it will make no difference to the number of guns on.
Yeah. And there we get back to a morality issue, and I do want to distinguish the difference between morality and religious views. You don't have to be religious to be moral.
Or ethical, maybe you mean.
Or ethics, yes.
Well, even moral in the sense of an individual decision that you make, that you don't like guns and you don't agree with them. And I actually, frankly, am in the same category you are. I don't own any guns.
Right. But
the three of us are probably pretty much on the same side.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen's got a whole lot of dead animals behind his head there hanging on the wall.
Not anymore.
I don't have them. I think the idea of stuffing and hanging animals on your wall is the most crude and disgusting activity I've ever seen. I would not want.
They're not mine. Too. They're not mine, and I didn't.
They're not Stephen's. He's somebody else's house.
Yeah, but anyway. Here's my point. Yeah. Let me finish this risk-based firearm policy. First, they suggest strengthening laws prohibiting individuals from buying or possessing guns after a short-term involuntary psychiatric hospitalization for higher risk of violence. So this would have been a person who had been incarcerated because they'd threatened to kill somebody. They'd have been involuntarily incarcerated.
Right.
Secondly, similar limits should be placed on people likely to be dangerous, such as those convicted of a violent misdemeanor, which means a non-felony, non-serious crime, those under a temporary domestic violence restraining order, and anyone convicted at least twice in 5 years of either misdemeanors involving a controlled substance or of driving while intoxicated. This is what I just told you. It's a consortium of
firearm policy. From Kansas. Repeat it.
This was written in Virginia.
Virginia.
Okay, let me finish it, and then you'll really have some stuff to go on. Permit law enforcement officers should be able to remove firearms when identifying someone who possesses an immediate or credible threat to self or others, the appropriate due process protection. In other words, people should be able to take away firearms.
Right.
Which they not currently do. Successful implementation of our recommendations depends on firearm transfers requiring a background check under federal law. So background checks have been really activated as real things that need to be done before anybody can be sold a weapon.
Now, this is what you're proposing?
This is what this consortium proposes that is not based on mental illness. It is based on very intense attempts by the government to do background checks and to issue guns only to people that have thoroughly been checked out beforehand Anybody who has a history of violence is under special protection. And I'll tell you why. Of all the things that predict the possibility of violence a second time is prior violence. However, what they don't say in here is that the chances of that predicting future violence is only 0.3. And a perfect prediction would be 1. And no prediction at all would be 0. So this is the best we can do. Prior violence that has reached a felony level should be looked at. But that's really not very good.
Is that what your position might be?
That's a position that I would say prevents, and it is my position, as far as it prevents people from victimizing mentally ill individuals who in general don't commit violence in excess of the general population.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Stephen, I think what Stuart, I think what you're saying is just because somebody's labeled as mentally ill, if they don't have, the government says they can stop them from having guns. But the point is that would mean that everybody with all sorts of mental illness couldn't have any guns.
Yes, but
and
Jill,
then they'd be in
Jill.
An unfair position, and you're saying that's an unfair position. Because only 0.3% have actually been known to be recidivists.
0.3 correlation.
See?
Correlation.
Felony, violence, convictions, and violence is only 0.3. And a perfect prediction would be 1. So you see, it's not even half, which means that 7 out of 10 people who commit violence for the first time are not necessarily going to convict violence again. So it's a poor correlation.
Dr. Twemlow, there have been many people come out here in the last few years, just since the first election of Barack Obama here in America, and they have said that they are going to start using psychological theorem, if you will, to start labeling good people, good law-abiding citizens that do have guns. Lost your video there again, Jill. Don't go out and do these things. They do jump through all the hoops that the government is currently making us jump through.
Absolutely.
To get guns, and they're going to start labeling these people as
not mentally ill.
Well, no, they're going to be start labeling them as mentally ill.
Oh, good God. Well, you see, the point is, mental illness is a medical category, as it shouldn't be in this area at all. The fact is, in America, people use guns. It's a young country. It's a synthetic country. It consists of lots of people who don't really want to be here. Unlike Australia, it is not created where all men are equal. Not all men are equal in America. Lots of people are here for all sorts of religious and other large group identity reasons that do not support the Constitution and are not in favor of the War of Independence or the Constitution.
Yeah.
We're different. We're not like other countries. We cannot just ban guns because, frankly, it won't ban guns. There'll be just as many guns as there were before.
That's right, because the bad guys won't follow the rules. Isn't Australia pretty close to the same as far as time frame and being a country as America is?
We changed because we came after the Reformation, so we have a different psyche. We came after a spiritual sort of enlightenment. So we're more enlightened than you are. Because
the people... This is a tiny little country that's been in existence for 200 years. You're part of a country that's been in existence for 2,000 years. We're different countries. And I think...
Australia was colonized.
You're part of the British Commonwealth. You've been under British common law for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. This country rejected British common law.
America, in a way, this is a theory that I heard, that America became a little bit retarded because the people who went to America, and this is just to be discussed, you know, the people who went to America were pilgrims. So they did not continue to, they became more sort of like hillbillies, like in the way that they didn't have the enlightened thinkers that helped them keep transforming their ideas about religion and about they didn't modernize, so they sort of stayed. Americans seem to be a little bit more backward in their, well, to, for as us Australians anyway, for me as an Australian, in the way there's such fundamentalist religious sort of attitudes, and they are like back before the period of enlightenment. They are more like pilgrims. They were, you were settled by a lot of pilgrims, and you have that sort of old pilgrim sort of view about God. And yeah, we see America as sort of pre-modern, a lot of my friends do, in terms of its relationship with empowering the individual and seeing the goodness in the other.
Well, I mean, as you know, I've lived in New Zealand, which is sort of a little bit more British oriented than your country, but still part of the colonies of the British Empire. And I've lived 40 odd years here. I actually agree with you in many respects. This country is full of crudities. You know, it does things that the British would consider very, very primitive. Now, your country was colonized by convicts, and that's the whole discussion. The way you treated the Australian Aborigine is no example of a civilized country.
No, but we had already been, but when we became isolated, we were isolated from a different jumping off point. We still brutalized the Australian Aboriginal. Yes. And we were absolutely terrible what we did. And we only gave the Aboriginal the vote 60 years ago, or 50 years ago.
1970.
Yeah, 1960-something. Yeah, 1970, yeah. That's another thing that you're talking about, Stu. We'll get to that on another show. You are have been in Australia doing work with Reconciliation Australia and with Lord John Alderdice. Oh, it's simple.
Yeah.
Back to the psyche of America and its use of guns and gun violence and control. And yeah, Stephen, I think you wanted to say something too, didn't you? No, Stephen might have gone again. So, Stuart, you've just been at a conference about gun violence.
I have, yeah.
What was the essence of what you got out of that?
Well,
what was the conference? You spoke at the conference too.
Yeah, I spoke about gun violence in America.
Mm.
There were three people that spoke about it. One was a psychiatrist analyst by the name of Dominic Balkan. He's been around the world, a very famous sort of diplomat psychoanalyst. He wrote the very first Arab-Israeli treaty. He was in the Kremlin at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989 and did psychotherapy with the Presidium Politburo.
Mm-hmm.
So shocked by these findings that people had thought were going to happen anyway. He's been in most of the major ethnic and serious political issues in the world for the past 40 years.
He's a big deal.
Peter Fonagy, who's a very famous psychologist from University College London.
Big on mentalizing, seeing the other person's point of view.
Right, he's a mentalizer. He just got the Order of the British Empire, which is a very
huge.
It's like a one step below a knighthood.
Mm-hmm.
And then me.
So what was the recommendation from the conference?
more study is needed.
Dr. Twemlow, could you maybe make some comments on some...
Well, I'll make some final comments on that particular outcome. I had serious disagreements with Peter and Barmick and also the chairman, Jeffrey Taxton. I don't think the killers, fascinating as they are, extraordinarily, obsessively fascinating as their ghastly life histories might be, and their awful family background, and their disgusting things they did to people, which all absorb us in a way that we should be embarrassed about, especially from your moral perspective, Stephen, nonetheless continue to fascinate us with programs like Dexter. You remember Dexter on television, Steve?
I never seen the show, but I know what you're talking about, yes.
Yeah, he's a forensic psychologist who on the side kills the people and tortures them to death on television. The thing I think is an absolute waste of time is to focus attention on the killers. I think it would be nothing. The killers aren't the cause of the problem. The killers are the results of the problem.
Such a sociological approach, psychosocial approach.
That's correct. In my opinion, the cause lies in the dysfunctional social system.
Yeah.
And we don't have time to talk about it now. But, you know, there are many ways a social system can produce killers to deal with their rage.
Sure.
So that somebody else becomes essentially a victim, a scapegoat. Steve.
Sure, yeah.
The social structure's dysfunction. And I think that's what these killers are. Look at Snowden.
Right.
This character is now becoming a hero. Wouldn't you agree, Steve?
Well, yes, he is becoming a hero. I'm really failing to see, maybe I don't have all the information, but what has he actually done wrong? He's a whistleblower. He's taking the moral high ground and telling the public, or WikiLeaks, if you will, yes, this is what the American government is doing and has done in the past and is doing now.
Yeah.
That's...
You see, I agree with you, but my point is, it's not that at all. He is going to become, has become, a public hero who in the end is going to be put in prison for terrorism.
Sure. A supposed terrorism,
yeah. He is going to be the scapegoat of the system's rage at him.
And Bradley Manning is another one, too.
I don't care whether he's a good guy or not a good guy. The fact is, he's not the cause of the problem.
No.
He caused the National Securities Administration to start to collect data on millions of people.
Yes.
He did not cause that.
Right.
That was a dysfunction of the social system.
Yes, yes.
And he should not be scapegoated for it.
No, he shouldn't. Do you think evil is a learned trait? Do you think evil is learned? Or do you think it's born?
I tell you what, you raise an interesting question because evil is a religious concept, and I'm not.
Well, aren't there evil acts?
What?
Aren't there evil acts? You don't have to be.
That
I have.
Sin.
I have this same argument about the label evil. Do go on. I argue with everyone about that. I say I don't believe in evil, and they go, "You don't believe in evil?"
Well,
and I go, "I know. I just."
You're,
but what do you mean by evil?
What do I mean by evil? Well, this war criminal that I don't even know if I should bring it up, but
it up. Fine.
No, don't bring it up.
No, the actual scenario that you're going to be studying.
Yeah. Okay. How could somebody be so without conscience or so without any moral sense or so without any sense of concern for children or others or knowledge of the law commit a crime like that. That's one issue. War criminals,
or even pedophilia, or even serial killers,
how could they do that? And the big issue is most of them turn out to be psychiatrically considered normal, let alone evil.
I think
very severe violence that you might call evil, because it's so extreme, is a temporary state of mind that you, Stephen, and you, Jill, and me, Stuart, could easily enter under the right conditions created by the social structure, particularly around issues of war, or what Volkan calls large group identity, i.e. my country is now at war, so you can kill people and get the Medal of Honor instead of being executed in a penitentiary. Those issues are so powerful, they can turn ordinary people into evil monsters. And you might say, how come that? I'm not an evil person. And I say, this, you know, you may not like. Yes, you are. You are a serial killer and a child molester in your heart, if necessary, and if it's allowed by your leaders. And you may say, well, I reject that. And I say, well, reject it all you want. It's the fact of the matter is that we are not perfect in any way at all. We are very, very borderline in terms of mental structure. We can do very bad things very, very easily.
Stephen, you need to keep asking your questions, but that sort of fits in with, like, I was just thinking, like, tabula rosa, like how the anything can be imputed upon the blank's slate of the mind.
Yeah.
And then there's all the potentialities in the collective unconscious.
Sure.
So that's sort of the two many ways in which we can look at it. So that really makes sense what you're saying. Stephen, I don't think you went from there being no evil, and that's back at your sort of, you know, blank slate theory, or that our mind is like, evil is a very complicated thing and the topic of another discussion. Stephen, are you still there, or have you wandered off again?
No, I'm here.
Well, come on, stick with your point, please, because
you're talking. What,
I know, when you draw breath, I think that you're not talking.
When I draw breath, okay. There's a.
I think. Oh, Stephen's got nothing to say.
There's a thing called.
He's breathing.
There's a thing called Skype delay, Jill. Have a delay. You two have a delay. You two hear each other before I do. There's a bit of a delay. I never get a word edgewise with anyone when there's more than one person on, and I still have a difficult time doing it with just one. Anyways, I have. We've got just about 5 or 6 minutes left here until we have to wrap up. But I wonder if maybe you've ever actually had any studies on state-sponsored terrorism, what they call false flag terrorism. There is evidence all over the world. Hitler burnt his parliament building down and blamed it on a communist that they found in a back alley.
That's right.
And that's basically what started World War, or he entered Poland after that.
Well, I know Chamberlain's famous comment that Hitler felt the biggest threat to the world was communism.
Sure.
But Chamberlain, as you remember, was fooled totally by Hitler. It wasn't until Churchill took him on that changed. The fact is, as Goebbels said, and I don't know if this is your little thing, if you repeat a lie enough times, everybody will come to believe it, especially if everybody repeats it.
Yes.
And so the fact is, the Nazi theory became part of what, if you didn't believe it, you would have to be asking questions about your own sanity.
Well,
and those people did exist. I had a patient who whose father was very close to her. He was he had a very high rank in the Nazi military, and she was very proud of him when she was a little tiny girl. And one day he came home in a big fret. It was about 1943 when the very first evidence came that the death camps were not placed in Germany, so Hitler could lie. They were mostly outside of Germany, most of them in Poland. And he had learned that the horrifying way people were being tortured and killed in death camps just because they were Jewish. And she remembers this very vividly as a time she could barely understand her father. He was going around the house, putting his fist through the walls. And then he came and sat by her and said, "I'm going to go now, my dear." And he put beside her his Nazi uniform and he said, "You'll probably never see me again." He said, I'm going to do things that will rectify this situation in the eye of the world." And he disappeared. She never saw him again. He joined the resistance. And there were many Nazis who didn't realize what Hitler was doing in the name of the German Republic.
Well, there were many that did, and they were hauled off and killed themselves.
And many of them said, "Well, all my neighbors and friends believe this. Maybe this guy's telling the truth."
Sure.
What can you say?
Yeah. Yeah, the government has always taken the appeal to authority issue, or the appeal to authority image on whatever it happens to be the issue. They always claim to be the authority and always claim that you are, they just have a personal insult if you don't believe every single word that they say. It's just a straw man attack.
Say, "My daddy says GIs eat their children," so they do. See, to me, large group identity is a very important part of this. If your group proscribes the issue, if it says it's okay to be a Nazi and you're a little kid or you're just a young person or even you're in your 20s or early 30s, you may say, "Oh well, you know, these Americans are pretty horrible people. I mean, the British are also been known to cause war all over the world. We got to fight to the death."
This is really interesting.
Why call them evil?
Just a couple minutes left now, Joe.
This is actually a really good ending, because what's happened here is what you're saying, Stuart, is that you've gone from spending all of these like 40 years analyzing people, and people, how people's personalities are constructed, and so much of the construction of our personality. A lot of people recognize that our personality is constructed by our family and our environment and the experiences that we have, and that can cause all sorts of neuroses. So what you're doing, and what you've had this argument with Peter Fonagy and the other fellow who's famous and whose name I've forgotten from the conference, is you're saying, well, if family can and environment can influence the mind, then of course society, which the family is a part of, must be influencing the mind. So murder and violence is a sociological impact and experience.
Right. People have called it, you know, the FBI calls them domestic terrorists. Another fighter calls them homegrown terrorists.
That's right.
And then they're terrorists, but they're part of the U.S. of A.
That's right. And then we get back to a morality and a ethical issue, I believe.
Correct.
Yeah. Well,
that's right.
Go ahead and wrap this up here, Jill. We're at the hour.
Okay, so it's been really wonderful having you here again. Thank you very much, Professor Twemlow. And thank you very much, Stephen Roberts, for having us on April Rain's We Raw Radio. And so long as you're available, we would love to see you again, Stuart. So we hope you'll come back very soon.
Certainly will.
And thank you, Stephen, very much for helping me
yes.
and being with me today
and supporting
me in this.
Yes, thank you, Jill, and thank you, Dr. Twomolo.
No problem.
Goodbye, everyone.